MK2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. You'll also hear as a CodeNet Control, Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick, as we claim to be net controls of this thing that's gone on for 28 years called the Technical Net, gathers people in the New York City area. They get together and discuss their favorite subject, ham radio and all the components connected to it. There's 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 25 or 26 kinds. There's a lot of other kinds. So if for some reason this one doesn't please you, before you give up the hobby entirely, try one of the other 24 or 25. The way the technical net is arranged is that, let me drop. We take in check-ins for people who do have a question or a comment for the net. Need not check in if you're just listening. If the 28 years and thousands of TechNet, this is TechNet number 1,352. By now we believe there are people listening in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. A lot of brain power there. We try to tap into that brain power. Sometimes we get some pretty wild questions, and thank goodness somebody in that area has experience and will sign in and tell us the results of his experience. Give us the benefit. We try to answer everyone's questions lightly in the first hour. In other words, if you sign in during the first hour, we try to give you at least a partial answer, and the deeper subjects we handle later. At the end of the first hour, Mel opens his mailbag, which means the people who have written to him by email or snail mail, because they're in the process of getting their ham radio license and can't get onto the TechNet vocally. The majority of what the TechNet does is a vocal exchange, real-time, like what you're hearing right now. We're not offering it necessarily as a free consulting written service. That's not what's being offered, although Mel does try to answer by written means, email or snail mail, the questions from brand new people that are getting into the hobby. Let me drop. At the end of the mailbag, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, will tell us the latest of what NASA has been doing. And after that, we go into the deeper subjects for the next couple of hours. Now, the deeper subjects do not please everyone, but you know it's coming. You know it's going to be there. To be forewarned is to be forearmed. If that displeases you, there's 800 channels on your 2-meter synthesized ham radio transceiver. You don't have to listen to this one. Listen to one of the other ones or go to some other band. We know, you know ahead of time we're going to be doing the deeper subjects at that time. There are people who will feel offended by the fact that we discuss deeper subjects on ham radio. And that's a little bit sad, because mankind really makes progress only when there is curiosity. You're listening to the sound of people having curiosity about things that are quite often into the world of physics and astrophysics and the microscopic world and whatever, the atomic state of matter. And that curiosity is where an awful lot of scientists in the past have made some very good progress. So you're listening to the sound of curiosity, and if that displeases you, please try not to get displeased. You know what's going to be happening. You're going to occasionally hear somebody who makes adverse remarks. He tries to do jamming, and he tries to give us what's the word I'm looking for now? Profanity. And that's not unique to this area. I've heard it in London. I've heard it in Los Angeles. I've heard it in San Francisco. I hear tell it happens in Dallas and Chicago and Miami. It's a sign of the times. Because of the way repeaters work, let me drop. A repeater covers a large number of square miles, hundreds and thousands of square miles in many cases. A person can have a low-power transmitter and do disruptive things, and for a short period of time, he can remain anonymous. And it's real easy to get angry at a person doing that. For at least two reasons, you shouldn't get angry. Number one, when you display your anger, you're just giving the person recognition. And that gives him encouragement to keep doing it. Second of all, a person isn't much bigger than the thing that makes him angry. You're listening to a sad human being who is unhappy with his life. He hears the sound of other people doing something that's pleasurable and challenging, and he tries to stop them from doing it. He wants to have control over that situation. So we should feel sadness for that person, not anger. That's an opinion. You may disagree with that opinion. I can understand that. So, right now, at this time, we're going to take check-ins. Please give me your call letters and your name, because I'm so darn forgetful on names, but I like referring to people by their name when I go back to them for the list of questions. Give me your call letters and name at this time, followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. K2RIW, TechNet, we're listening.
WHYY, Joe, question and comment.
Richard, yes.
Okay, I think the Rich may be was into EO. Is that true?
Sir.
Okay, so we got Joe and Rich in that order. Is there a third person to sign in?
KC2MDP, Steve, yes.
Questions?
Okay, I was a double. I heard Steve, who was the fourth person who said questions.
K2KYQ, name is Joe, no questions.
Okay, Joe with an O. Steve with a yes. One last call. Anyone else with questions or comments? Give me your call letters right now.
N2MB.
Okay, I heard N2MB. Barry, you do have a question or a comment, Barry?
Not yet. Not at this time. I just got here.
Okay, Mr. N2 Moon Bounce. He quite often comes up with a question. You wait and see. And one last question. Was there anyone else?
K2KEY, good evening all.
Mel recognized. Anyone else? Okay, we got more than enough. Joe, with question or comment, go right ahead. Joe's the guy who does most of the amount of high-definition television DXing. He's got a rotatable antenna. He's got some pretty fancy instrumentation. He aims his antenna in various places, and there are times when he has heard high-definition digital television signals from quite a few states away. Go right ahead, Joe, with your question or comment. B2RYY, K2RIW.
I've got to turn this radio down here. Okay. The first thing is a comment. Yes, I was watching digital television about, give or take, about a week or so ago, and I noticed Channel 2 was getting the hell beat out of it. The picture was breaking up, and it was breaking up for quite a length of time, like about 10, 15 minutes of the clip. Being that I have a spectrum analyzer handle, I hooked it up to the same input that the converter sees. I wanted to see visually what I was seeing, what the converter was seeing off the air. Sure enough, I was seeing impulse noise. And the impulse noise was going from about 350 megahertz up to about past 700 megahertz, but not in the VHF band. It was actually somebody mowing the lawn about three, four blocks away from that. Maybe two blocks away from that. I could hear it very lightly. And when the antenna was pointed in that direction, that's what it was picking up. It's kind of odd that it would pick up something just in one portion of speak frequency of the band and not really in others. But that's not my question. The question is, on some of these channels, and I noticed that some channels are getting beat up worse than others. Some weren't getting bothered at all within that frequency range. The ones that were getting beat up were the ones that had this rather unusual pattern that you could see off the air. It was not a complete pattern filling across the 6 megahertz bandwidth. They were getting beat up more than the others. And my question, here's the question. I've asked this before and I didn't get an answer for it the first time I tried to ask it over here. And is what fills in the difference on these type of signals that you can receive off the air that are coming from New York City, one of the buildings in New York City, probably the Empire State Building, that actually have a difference in depth of amplitude from about varying 10 to 15 decibels. What fills in the difference in these areas where the signal is below the threshold of what the converter is trying to see? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, rather nice question on the subject of a couple of questions on the subject of high-definition digital over-the-air broadcast television. Mr. Spagnoli, I can't think of the spelling of his name right now. I got a report sitting right here. Spagnoli, S-G-R-I-G-N-O-L-I, Spagnoli. Mr. Spagnoli, a consulting engineer, is one of the major fathers or creators of the so-called 8VSB high-def television standard that we're using in the United States. They're using a different standard in Europe. And there's pros and cons of each of the standards. But when you look at the television, high-def television signal, ATS, I guess it's called, advanced television system, as it is broadcast on a spectrum analyzer, it has an appearance on the screen which people call Bart's head performance, in other words, Bart's haircut. It looks noisy, but the noise has an extremely sharp, it's got a flat line of noise across the top of the screen represents the amplitude versus frequency across the 6 megacycle wide channel. And I've got a couple of guesses here. It is my belief that most of the time, as broadcast, that thing is fairly filled in. Although, I've got a little bit of question on that one. Let me drop. And this is one of the things we have to check out with Eric, KE2EJ, who is the chief engineer for PBS Channels 13 and PBS Channel 21 in the New York City area. So he's got direct hands-on experience that he can confirm or deny the speculation I'm about to give you. My speculation is that, as broadcast, that signal is normally filled in with a flat Bart's head. I got a slight doubt about that because some of the channels have only one programmed piece of material per 6 megs, and some of them have two or three videos and a couple of audios, and are those more filled in? There, I'm not sure. But I'm going to make a guess that usually it is filled in. The nature of multipath is that as you swish in frequency across the 6 megacycles, and you've got a direct signal coming through the air between Empire State Building and your antenna, and an indirect one, and there's a zillion ways the indirect one is happening simultaneously. You've got a signal bouncing off the ground nearby, far away, off the water tower, off the buildings. You've got lots and lots of bouncing signals, and they all get combined in a very complicated way at your receiving antenna. And the nature of multipath is that it will create bumps and valleys of a signal that started off as flat, and you're going to see peaks and valleys because of the multipath. It may not be the only reason, but I think it's one of the reasons. And as the multipath gets more severe, as it approaches approximately 12 decibels of peak-to-valley ratio, I think many of the digital converters we use will cease to operate correctly. Let me drop. Okay, Eric is there with a little bit of buzz on your signal. He's going to fill us in. Also, many of the reports written by Mr. Scrignoli have indicated that when they did over-the-air testing at various frequencies, they found out that one of the slight disadvantages of the ATS system that we're using, 8BSB, is that it is relatively vulnerable to impulse noise, particularly at the lower frequencies. Your lower VHF frequencies, they discovered ignition noise and power line noise and whatever, could break up that signal. So that's part of what I think is going on. Let's see what Eric's got to say. As you can tell, Eric, Joe is experiencing on his spectrum analyzer the signals that he's having difficulty receiving, like Channel 2, the one that is advertised as Channel 2, has been giving us all quite a bit of trouble over the air lately. And so when he looks at it with a spectrum analyzer, he sees this peak-to-valley ratio across the 6 dB, and I think that's not the way it's broadcast. I am guessing multipath is doing that. See if you agree or disagree, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Okay, I apologize. It was a funeral caused by it. We're talking about Channel 2, Channel 4, Channel 9, which is on the CBS antenna. And if you look at it, it is very flat looking. It looks like it's got a sine wave with peak and valley in it. Hello, folks. It's emanating from the Empire State Building like that. The reason why, we've had this discussion about the backfill antenna. When they turn the backfill antenna off, it becomes a nice flat line again. So, we've had the discussion with the various, around the letters that have gone back and forth between me and the guy responsible for it. It's not the life of New York City. So don't think that it's multipath being created by some object. It's multipath being created by the broadcaster.
Fantastic. I should let you know, Eric, that the 120-cycle rectified noise on your signal is slightly louder than your audio, and your audio is a bit low. So I'll repeat what Eric just said, because I'm listening to him with earphones, and I'm listening to him on the input at the same time, and that is, Because of the backfill antennas that are being used at Empire State Building on channels 2, 4, and 9, the scalloping appearance that Joe W-A-2-R-Y-Y is experiencing is coming out of the broadcaster. And so, although multipath could be aggravating that, the broadcaster is doing it. So in other words, the signal is starting off with marginal performance, and therefore I'm going to guess that the amount of additional impulse noise or additional multipath characteristics that those three channels can tolerate is decreased. I'm going to pass it back in a minute to Eric for a confirmation on that. So the signal is starting off in a marginal manner for most of the people out in the further areas where Joe and I live. We both live in Suffolk County. That fill antenna maybe is giving good performance in Brooklyn, but for the people out here, we're having a fair amount of grief, and so the scalloping created by the interference, in other words, because the signal is going to the main broadcast antenna and the fill antenna, which is supposed to be giving you extra signal under the umbrella, if you know what I mean, for the people that are in close, because those two feed line lengths are not carefully phased matched at each of those three channels, you therefore have signals that are creating an interferometry pattern in elevation, and therefore you see the scalloping, which makes the signal more marginal. I wonder if that's approximately true on this additional marginalness where it has less tolerance of multipath and impulse noise. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Now, you know, if the antennas were done right and phased properly, it wouldn't be an issue. But they're more concerned about giving Brooklyn a signal than they are about the rest of the place. You know, out to the west they don't have that problem. Up to the north they don't seem to have that problem at all either. It's just that the infrasymbol distortion that goes on reduces the margin that the receivers can deal with. And by the way, one of these days, Channel 2 will be transmitting from Plainview on Channel 22. K2RIW, K2J.
Okay, so 2 will be in 20 on 22. In other words, what is advertised as 2, marketed as 2, will really be on Channel 22, 500 some odd megacycles from Plainview, right alongside of your Channel 21. Eric, where some of the Advanced Television System channels have essentially only one piece of program material during certain hours of the day, and other times it has three or four videos and a couple of audios, if I was looking at the pure broadcast signal as it comes out of the transmitter before being distorted by antenna characteristics, would I see a difference in the flatness of the Bart's head depending on the amount of program material, or would always still look like a Bart's head? I am guessing it would still look like a Bart's head. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
I think you're absolutely correct. Whether you're transmitting no information or dozens of information, the bit rate that signal is made is 19.395 blah, 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 bits per second. And whether you have content or you don't have content, you're always sending out packets. The packets are 188 bytes wide, and it's a continuous stream. So whether there's data there or there's no data there, there's always a stream happening. So you would absolutely see no difference whatsoever in the RF output based on content like you would with an analog transmitter.
Dick?
Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. I'm not sure if you get into the heart of my question, because the heart of the question basically is this. I'll state it again. When you have these type of patterns, and I'm well aware that these signals are like this, and some channels are flat, some channels have this scallop type of pattern, as you call it. My question again was, what fills in the difference as far as the converter is concerned with in the areas where the signal is much lower than the peak signal? From peak to valley, say you've got a difference of 10 to 15 decibels. At the points where it's very low compared to the height of the carrier, what fills in the difference as far as the converter sees?
That's a darn good question, and I'm going to pass it over to Eric with a little addition to that. When it comes to properly demodulating radar pulses, there's an often used rule of thumb, and that is it requires approximately 12 decibels of peak envelope to noise ratio, call it carrier to noise ratio if you like, displayed on an A-scope in order to get high probability of good detection of the radar signals, 90% probability of detection, and some kind of a 10 to the minus 5 false alarm rate, so to speak, proper setting of threshold. So good radar performance requires around 12 dB. It's a somewhat digital signal that's also being transmitted here, and I'm guessing that in the vicinity of 12 dB, a peak-to-valley ratio, again, is required of signal above noise, not necessarily signal above the adjacent scalloped area. However, I am going to guess that there's a degree of redundancy and there's a degree of error-correcting code, a little bit like a Viterbi error-correcting code that is present in the protocol of the ATS signal. These are a bunch of guesses on my part. So Eric's going to tell us how does Joe's real good converter fill in those spaces of what he thinks is missing information. KE2EJ, your audio is a lot better now. K2RIW.
2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, turn this on the generation of receivers. You get a good receiver with something called a fifth or sixth generation equalizer. They can deal with those differences. But in the actual RF part of the transmission, we have a process called trellis. And what we do with trellis is sort of like a commutating, there's a built-in error correction at the RF level, and there's another error correction at the actual decoded level. So there's error correction on the stream which contains the data. There's error correction on the outside or in the RF portion of the signal. We actually use three symbols to illustrate one bit at the RF level. And that's what the trellis does. And that runs by a series of lookup table in terms of what bits are supposed to be set at what particular point in time. The actual ATSC standard picked a number of the carrier to noise ratio of a minimum of 27 dB. You will find receivers that work well at 18, 19, 20 dB in terms of carrier to noise. The better it is, the more you get. Even if the scallop is above 27 dB, you still get reception, even though there's a lot of ups and downs in the equalizer kind of takes care of that.
K2RW, K2J. K2KY comments.
Mel recognized. A further question I've got for you, Joe, Eric, before we lose you, and that is that is there a way that Joe can quantify how many dB down is a scallop, and even if the valley of the scallop is still above the noise the right amount, if he's got a good antenna getting a pretty strong signal from Empire State Building, is there a way that we can slightly quantify, even in a rough manner, how many dB down, how many megacycles wide, and how many of them where a good fifth or sixth generation equalizer type ATSC decoder can handle the signal? Is there a way we can quantify where beyond that point the signal is too distorted and probably cannot be recovered? I know that's a vague question, but maybe you've got an answer with some of the laboratory experiments that you know about, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
There was a whole series of experiments done in the lab and those done in the real world. You actually could, depending upon your receiver, some receivers will have like a little bar that tells you signal strength. Well, actually, for the first little part of it, it's signal strength. The rest of it, it's actually error rates, and the higher the error rate, the lower the bar reads. Some receivers will actually give you an ETNO number, an actual error bit rate number based upon number of missed bits. Because bits were missed doesn't mean that you're gone, they're actually mathematically replaced. So there actually are tools like I've shown you, you equalizer that I have where I can actually see what the taps are doing, when the taps are actually on or off. And they're shifting phase and time of the signal to compensate for the differences in what you see as RF level. You know, multicast is a complex issue in a digital signal because it's not only a change in amplitude, but there's also changes in phase. Because you're trying to use a slice of time to get bit information, you get errors that way if it's delayed in time. The equalizer can say, oh, you know, this reflected signal is actually stronger than the main signal. I think I'll lock up to that, and you can get a picture out of it. K2IW, K2IW.
Thank you, Eric, we've now got a little more information as to how much of that scalloping that Joe can tolerate, although making it quantitative, of course, is a little bit difficult. It looks like the basic scalloping coming out of channels 2, 4, and 9, because of the fill antennas that are trying to favor the close-in areas like Brooklyn, and Mel lives in Brooklyn, so the antennas that give your community better reception are giving us grief out here, Mel. Look at the problem you're causing us. Mel is also one of the rare people using over-the-air television reception, not getting it by satellite cable or whatever. KE2EJ. Sorry about that. K2KEY. K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. I'll tell you about an observance. As you said, I'm getting it over-the-air. I am getting 30-plus channels. I've noticed that a few weeks ago, as the grass now started to grow here on the lawns, a neighbor of mine, a couple doors down, has an electric lawnmower. In other words, one of these lawnmowers that has an extension cord, and he's cutting the grass. And I noticed that just about killed the reception on, I'd say most of the channels, Dick. It's amazing. It just, all of a sudden, they just freeze up as he starts the lawnmower, and then you get the no signal. Following that, I found that I almost duplicate the same situation. If I have this system on, the TV on and all, and I turn on my plug-in electric shaver, I get basically the same situation, that it actually disrupts and stops the reception. That it's amazing. This stuff seems to be, over the air, seems to be extremely critical to noise levels. Over.
Yeah, my reading...
Hey, copy.
My reading of what Mr. Scrignoli has said, and somebody who said, do I copy? We're going to go over to you in a second, sir. What Mr. Scrignoli said with some of his experiments does confirm impulse noise vulnerability of the system. The good news about the ATSC over-the-air high-definition television signal is that as long as the signal is above threshold and has the right characteristics, you get a snow-free, essentially perfect picture and audio. Back in the old days of analog television, as impulse noise and weak signal came along, you either got snow or you got snowflakes and streaks and things like that, but you could still see the picture underneath the noise. And if television interference was happening from a ham radio transmitter, you usually heard some portion of the audio or a distorted version of the audio, and you knew where it's coming from. Now the various things that will stop television ATSC proper reception just make the audio disappear, make the picture disappear, or make it blotchy and make it move in steps and then stop. And so whether it is impulse noise, whether it's lawnmower noise, whether it's ham radio, you can't tell. The good news is that we hams are not as easily being blamed because the picture just disappears. And you have almost no information as to what caused it. But the bad news is that it's got this extremely hard threshold that gives me a lot of grief. Two of my channels, they happen to be two, occasionally four, and occasionally nine, where if the atmospheric conditions and whatever are just not right, I may be trying to watch one of my favorite programs, 60 Minutes, and the audio gets interrupted periodically, and it's quite annoying because Murphy's Law will dictate that just when they're giving the net result of some investigation and they're giving the bottom line, that's when the audio drops out, and if you're not good at lip reading, you don't get it. And sometimes the picture freezes, too. The person who says, can I hear you? Who was that? Give me your call letters and your name. KQRIW in the tech net.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Hello, Dick. This is Bell, WB2CUK. I'm testing a radio for a friend at TR7930 with an unusual transmit problem. But I also have a question for the tech net, if you'd like to entertain one.
Very fine, Bill. Bill runs the swap and shop every Monday night, and you're added to the list, Bill. We've got four people who signed in, and as you know, we try to promise everyone a brief answer during the first hour, and if you're willing to hang around a little bit longer than that, we may or may not get to you. Okay, I think we've given you a fair amount of information as to what we know about what you're seeing with your receptions, Joe, and please come back more often and let us know what's going on with your experiments with high-def over the television. Rich, N2EO, what would you like to tell us about tonight, K2RIW?
Okay, good evening, Dick. Good evening, TechNet, N2EO. Dick, I wanted to do a follow-up on that 10 gigahertz transmitter I ordered. It came. It is a CARS band transmitter. I'm not sure what CARS stands for, but I was going to send you an email with some pictures. And I have a partial manual here, but I'll give you an overview. I think I'm going to have a lot of questions. This is going to be a winter's project. But it says here, use AML series high power microwave transmitter model STX-141. Puts out 5 watts between, 12.7 and 13.25 gigahertz. It says VHF input frequencies, 50 to 450 megahertz. And what they're showing here basically in the block diagram, let me let it reset. Okay, they're showing a solid state source with a crystal oscillator. They're showing goes into an up converter. A VHF input on the up converter has a level set adjustment, comes out, goes into a Klystron amplifier. It is not an oscillator. In the diagram it says Klystron amp. Inside the unit there's a tag that says Klystron amp. Comes out, there's a crystal detector followed by a bandpass filter and a harmonic filter. And it says here, power output 5 watts plus 37 dBm. And so I'm wondering if you have any idea. This is obviously linear because it's good. It's used in video service. I want to use it in narrowband single sideband service on 10.368. I will send you some more information to K2RIW TechNet Weimark and 2EO.
Sounds like an uplink transmission.
Yeah, what, Eric, the broadband information transmission technique for roughly 20 years ago, called CARS band, C-A-R-S, I wonder if you know what that stands for, and give us your impression of the equipment that that Rich is describing to us, Eric. K-E-2-E-J, K-2-R-I-W. Start off with what does CARS stand for, if you know.
Commercial Auxiliary Radio Service. It sounds like if it was in terrestrial service, it was used like the phone company, I think. It's funny what the horns that the phone company had point-to-point. It's actually on the satellite uplink frequency. If it's 20 years old, it's probably a microwave that was used for, a wide bandwidth audio circuit, which the phone company multiplexed. Made subcarriers out of each phone call, and they generate 200 or 300 megahertz worth of it, and to go point to point. So that's probably what it was.
Take this says it was used in CATV service.
Yeah,
is it particularly a Heterodyne box?
Yeah, your box has got something like WR62 or WR75 waveguide as its main output from that. Klystron, is that true? That's the easiest way to pin down the frequency region. Over to you, Rich.
Dick, in fact, right on the back, there's a flange to go to WR-75, and that's what it says in the manual.
Who's the manufacturer?
Microwave Products Division, model STX-141, Eric.
What's the name of the company?
Hughes is a Hughes Aircraft Company.
Don't pick up. Hit the mic first, then talk.
Yeah, I think that always helps. Okay, sorry. Hughes Aircraft Company, Hughes, is in Howard Hughes, model STX-141.
Okay, I think I know what that is. By the way, Hughes makes a lot of, VSAT equipment, which is, when you go to the gas station, see the little dish on the top of the roof, and when they use the cash register, it actually sends up the satellite back to home office. It's a very narrow aperture, up and down link. But if it's wide bandwidth, it's probably a part of the enterprise then. What the cable companies would do is to get from site to site, because the analog television is AM, they would take a whole chunk to the band, now don't forget their band is continuous, starts from below 15 and goes through the mid channels, and there's middle channels, they even have channels on 2 meters, so to speak. And they would have a continuous chunk of 300 megahertz, and that's what they would transport from place to place, and just down converted again, it becomes RF.
As I see it, Rich, the fact that your output is WR-75, which implies that it was emphasizing the frequency region of around 10 to 15 gigahertz, maybe 12 to 15 gigahertz, it's the right frequency region nearby to what you want. WR-75 is a very acceptable piece of waveguide for the 10.368 gigahertz ham radio band. And if it was a traveling wave tube that was doing the amplifying, moving it down in frequency is extremely easy. The fact that it's a Klystron amplifier makes it a little bit more difficult. Moving a Klystron is not so easy, because the way the Klystron works is that it has the equivalent of a cathode ray tube. It's got a gun assembly. It's got a focusing network. It tries to issue a nice, skinny electron beam between the cathode and the anode that's some number of inches away. And along that length, along the sides of this tube of focused electrons by that external magnetic assembly, you have a bunch of tuned circuits which do velocity modulation. And the net result is you've got bundles of electrons that arrive at the far end, and the bundle of electrons at the far end is much bigger than the bundle that gets launched at the near end by the signal that you put into it. That's the method by which it achieves gain. To move it in frequency means you've got to move those individual tuned cavities. It may be doable, and so there's not as much experience of moving Klystrons among the 10 gig ham radio operators as there is to moving a traveling wave tube. You can buy a traveling wave tube that is designed for 12 gigahertz, and believe it or not, you could use it at 6 gigahertz, and vice versa. If you know what you're doing, Klystrons can't be moved anywhere near that far, but in your case, you don't have to move it quite as far. Also, there are solid-state amplifiers that will substitute for that particular portion. So we don't have a completely clean yes or no answer yet as to how easy it is going to be for you to use that.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And by the quick introduction I gave to the 10 gig ham band last week, we discussed WR-75 rectangular waveguide. We discussed the 3/4 inch round copper tubing that you can buy in Lowe's or Home Depot, which serves as a beautiful waveguide for these frequencies. The hams have been doing that for some time. And the individual components to make antennas and horns and whatever at those frequencies, homebrew. The guys in England have been homebrewing those components for the last 30 years. In fact, there was separate divisions of the Radio Society of Great Britain where there was a parts department, so to speak, where volunteer amateurs would generate these components and sell them, swap them, whatever, with people that are getting onto the band. There's a bit of a learning curve, as you're about to find out, but it's about time that somebody create another wave of interest of the 3-centimeter ham band, as we call it, the 10 gig ham band, and Bruce into LIV and I created quite a chunk of activity around the year 2000. A bunch of things got complicated in our lives. We sort of dropped the project, and it's time to get reinstated. N2EO, K2RIW in the tech mantle.
Okay, Dick, very good. K2RIW, Tech at Weimark, N2EO. Well, let me say this. To get something, sometimes you got to give something. And if I could get some help with this over the winter, you know, I'm the only one here right now. I'm living alone. So if you guys want to, let's say, you resurrect the 10X, 10 gigahertz scoop, and have meetings over here and work on stuff downstairs. I've got a shop down here. I don't have the equipment for microwave, but I'm sure we can come up with stuff. If you want to do that, you're more than welcome. Back to you, Dick, N2EO.
An attractive offer. And so check in from time to time. We'll give you, I mean, up till now you've heard 5 or 10% of the information you'd like to know as to how the operations proceed on narrow band techniques. When it comes to 10 gig ham radio, in the very beginning, it was broadband techniques, FM modulated. Yes, they were using Klystron oscillators way back in the 1950s, and later on they were using gun diode fed transmitters, gun plexers they were called, a gun multiplexer transmitter receiver setup, FM, so-called wideband techniques. And then around around 1980 or so, the smarter guys started building up narrowband, single sideband, and Morse code type techniques, coherent oscillators as opposed to free-running oscillators. And they got approximately a 30 decibel improvement in receiver sensitivity when they did that. That's the good news. The bad news is the transmitter's a little bit more persnickety, a little bit more elaborate. So when it comes to narrowband techniques, which is what 95% of all the guys are doing these days on 10 gigs, wideband is still used as an experiment, but it's nowhere near as popular. Alrighty, the next person was Steve, KC2MDB. Steve, what would you like to ask the TechNet tonight? K2RIW?
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to all on the net. Dick, I'm trying to tune a UHF duplexer, and I'm trying to do this the poor man's way. This is what I tried. Tell me if I'm in the ballpark or not. Basically, what I did is I took a antenna analyzer and a dummy load, connected the dummy load to the antenna port, and, hooked the antenna analyzer to the transmit port, and I tune it to the opposite frequency and try and get the highest SWR. Then I do it the reverse and try and get the highest SWR. Then I do it, you know, the normal way and, see what the SWR was there. And it was about 1.2. I mean, would this get me in the ballpark, or am I just, whistling in the wind, so to speak? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, tuning up a transmitting, receiving, duplexing filter. And the duplexing filter usually is applied to a single antenna repeater, where you're transmitting and receiving out of the same antenna simultaneously. In the case of the 450 ham band, usually there's 5 megacycles of separation between transmit frequency and receive frequency. So there's either 3 or, let me think now, either 4 or 6 total cavities. I guess the popular way of doing it. So you at times have as many as 3 cavities tuned to the transmit frequency connected to the antenna, 3 cavities tuned to the receiver frequency connected to the antenna, and those two groups of 3 cavities come together with a Y connector at the antenna, making the insertion loss on the transmit cavities low and loss at the transmit frequency, and making the insertion loss low and loss at the receive frequency for the receive cavities relatively easy to do. However, when you're going through the complete procedure in order to make sure that your repeater is not being desensitized by the leakage path of some of the transmit signal getting into your own receiver, and you'd like the receiver to have a small fraction of 1 microvolt of sensitivity, that's a sensitivity of around minus 120 dBm, and the transmitter maybe is putting out 50 watts, which is plus 55 dBm, if I got the numbers right, maybe it's plus 45. I see 10 watts is plus 40, yes. 50 watts would be around plus 47 dBm, I think it is. So there's a power...
2 meter, transmit.
There's a power spread of something like 150 decibels between the weakest signal you want to receive and the strongest transmittal you want to transmit. And therefore, getting that specific amount of notch cannot be done with a antenna analyzer, antenna tuner, VizWAR measurement. You can barely do it with a really good, properly set spectrum analyzer. It's a bit of an art form to really tune that correctly. Without that deep notch of the transmit frequency being notched out to the receiver, you're going to suffer some amount of descents. So by the techniques you're using, you can get into the town, not quite into the ballpark, and you're certainly not going to get to home plate. So it does require better instrumentation, and even with the better instrumentation, because the on-screen dynamic display of a good spectrum analyzer is rarely beyond 100 decibels, and you need a bare minimum of 120 decibels of isolation, you have to use some other techniques. So go ahead and try it. You're not going to explode anything. It's not going to catch on fire. But don't be disappointed if your repeater receiver does become desensitized whenever you're running more than a few milliwatts of power, so to speak, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And so we go with CarMedic.
WB2HWW, with two questions and comments on the subject.
Okay, we got Rich and Howie in that order. Rich, go ahead.
Okay, I agree, Dick. He can get very close, and I think he's got the right idea. I told you what I had done when I redid that tank circuit in that linear amplifier. What I did was, this is for the gentleman's benefit, I put the antenna analyzer into the output of the amplifier and terminated the tube with the power off with a resistor to simulate the plate load impedance of the tubes, which was about 900 ohms. He's doing basically the same thing by putting a load on the cavity and jamming the analyzer into the other port. Let me let him reset.
Let me stop you, Rich. The tuning of a amplifier of a transmitter, the tuning section, is very different than tuning a duplexing filter. Yes, you will get a good tune that way, but you won't come even close to the requirement of isolation that's requiring for a duplexing filter. Let me go over to Howie, because Howie has been running repeaters with duplexing filters for a large number of years. Guarantee you've been through that tuning procedure for duplexing filters, Howie. And what have you done to get that extra dB beyond, the extra 20 dB beyond the dynamic range on the screen of a really good spectrum analyzer? You've got it, Howie, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, let me just say one thing, and then I'll let it go to Howie. What I was going to suggest was that the gentleman, instead of trying to do the whole duplexer, do one cavity at a time, and then put the cavities together. And don't go for the rejection. Go tune each cavity with a load on it, and the analyzer going in, so he gets a good match, a good SWR, not a bad SWR where he's trying to get a reject, but get a pass. Do it cavity by cavity, then put them together and possibly tweak it a little bit closer. I think he'll get fairly close. You're right, he does need better equipment, but I think this is a better way to fudge it. Back to you, Dick, and turn it over to Howie.
Yeah, in my opinion, that approach is not likely to give him what he's looking for, Rich. You've used good common sense, but I guarantee you have not successfully tuned a duplexing filter intended for repeater service with that procedure. The chances of success are very slim. There's a lot more required. Howie, go ahead and tell me what you had to do. K2LIW.
Oh, I've had help. I've actually had Joe LYY many years ago tune up a duplexer for me. What you can do with a service monitor is put a little bit of amplification in there. Instead of running 0 dBm, you go to plus 20 dBm and be very careful. You can even go to 30 dBm, but you got to make sure that you're far enough down that you don't hurt the duplexer. The question I had for him, and based on the type of duplexer, Dick, I'll be able to give him some ideas. There's a lots of ways that you, if you don't have a spectrum analyzer, he can use a broad watt meter, he can use a receiver, but you all want to look at SWR, because when you look at the SWR, are you looking at the pass frequency or the reject frequency? The cam will have both a pass and a notch as part of the filter. So let me find out what kind of a duplexer it is. You know, if it's a PD526, it's going to be very hard. You know, if it's a DB products or some of the duplexes, you can actually use a bird watt meter. They have bird watt meters that will go down to 100 milliwatts, and you can actually do it that way. I've actually tuned past cavities. I've tuned up a past cavity using a bird watt meter and an HT. It's been done before. You're right, you got to get decent. But let's find out what kind of duplex he has, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead and tell us, Steve, what's the model number, how many cavities. It'll help a little bit in what we're trying to tell you about.
Okay, Dick, very good. It's a cell wave. It's a six-cavity duplexer. It's fairly small. It's probably about 8 by 10 and maybe, you know, an inch and a half in depth. And the model number is TDN something. I didn't get the whole thing while you guys were talking. I ran in there real quick and looked at it. It's TDN something. Back to you.
Beach Royal, I would comment.
Duplexer, or is this the base station duplexer? Is the duplexer completely enclosed, or do you see the individual cans?
You see the individual cans, but it's, they're basically, it's all soldered together. You know, basically you have, you know, you transmit, your antenna, and you receive, and basically the whole thing's, soldered together, so it's not like you can isolate any of the filters itself. Back to you.
Okay, that's rigid lines. Is this a, okay, it sounds like a UHF duplexer. It sounds like it's a mobile duplexer. Depending on, sometimes these duplexers will have rejects on the receiver and pass on, although it passes on the receiver and rejects on a transmitter. Is this, are there six pass rejects, or am I correct? Is this a mobile duplexer?
Yeah, it's got six little adjusters on it. I bought it at the Ham Fest today. It's probably mobile. It's fairly small.
Yes. Right, wait a minute. Are there two adjustments on each can? Because what you'll have is in the center of the can, you'll have a rod, that's your pass, and then over near the connector, you'll have like another screw, which would be your reject. Some duplexes will have both a pass and a reject, and they track each other. Do you know if this is a pass only or a pass reject or a notch only duplexer?
Mobile duplexes are typically notch only.
You're right, Joe, so it's a notch only. Well, you can use a watt meter and just tune for, you know, you can use a watt meter tune for minimum output, but that's not going to do it that well. That gets very tricky. You probably need a spectrum analyzer. Joe, you go ahead. You know more than I do about this stuff.
W2OI with it. The comment I was going to make is it's hard to tune a mobile duplexer with a watt meter to try to look at your notch depth. These duplexes typically might be anywhere from 50 to 80 dB of notch depth, totally between an antenna port and the receiver port. There's a danger if you don't have the notches tuned right. You can easily have the notches have nowhere near the reject you need between your transmitter and receiver, and you can actually physically damage your receiver if you don't have enough notch depth to keep the transmitter power out of your receiver port of your receiver. It can actually do some damage to the front end. That's number one. And number two is I don't agree with tuning the duplex with RF power applied.
typically something more than 20 milliwatts, I mean, say 100 milliwatts power or more, you stand a chance of arcing the connectors, the adjustments inside because of putting RF current across it as your adjustment. None of these manufacturers suggest you put power in the duplexer to tune them. That's a fallacy, if you think it is a good way to tune the duplexer. I don't agree with that method.
Great, no, I absolutely agree with Joe. You really don't want to put more than 100 milliwatts. If you try to do that, you could arc weld it. The station with the duplexer, what are you going to be using this in a repeater? Because you really can't get away with a reject-only duplexer because you have no receiver. You have no receiver and transmitter cleanup. You really need a pass reject.
Yes, this is eventually going to be a base station repeater.
I'm going to tell you something. You might as well go out and get yourself a real duplexer because what's going to happen is this. Is that you? When you're looking at the receiver, you're still going to have to add an extra cavity or two, and 80 dBs is not enough to make a repeater work. Even if the repeater is running 20 or 30 watts, you're just not going to get good service. A mobile duplexer can be used. A lot of those duplexers are used like in radio telephones or an IMTS service or in a full duplex where you're listening to a real strong signal, but trying to build a repeater using a reject-only duplexer, like a mobile duplexer, and I think Joe will back me up on this, that it's just not, you're just going to be wasting your time. Let me go over to Dick, and Dick can throw it to Joe, but I don't mean to burst your bubble, but trying to do it with a mobile duplexer is just not going to work. Go ahead, Dick.
ACKEY, want to comment?
Mel recognized. Steve, don't give up. What we're letting you know is that the equipment that you own may not be adequate for the service you desire. Not enough cavities, not enough reject, and it's going to require a good spectrum analyzer and maybe some additional cavities to be added. But don't give up. You're a member of a 350-member club. It's got people like Andy, the V2CDL, who knows how to do that kind of an alignment, and he's got the equipment to do it. He has contacts that will get you the one or two or three extra cavities you might need to add to this thing to make it into a full high-performance duplexer. What I'm hearing is that you've got 80% of the hardware you need. There's another 20% of hardware, another 50% of knowledge and test equipment for tuning it up in order to get what you want. So don't throw it away. Don't give up. Just that it's a little more work than you thought at first. Let's see what Mel's got to say. But you've turned up a few duplexing filters in your time, you and your group, K2KEY and K2RIW.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Having made them from scratch years ago, you know, going way back, if I do go back a few years, what I did with the homebrew ones, and they were fairly successful, believe it or not, made out of pipe. Basically, you know, everything was put together out of pipe, mounting them on wooden frames, the whole business. What I usually did, and like I say, was somewhat successful, as Howie said, using a low-power transmitter, a watt meter, and a dummy load. The transmitter cavities, I tuned them to deliver maximum power to a 50-ohm load, and I used the same procedure used for the receiver cavities, but set the transmitter set to the receive frequencies. And I think, fairly good success, Dick. Over.
As you can tell, Steve, there's a bit of an art form to properly tuning up one of these filters. You don't necessarily tune for the lowest possible insertion loss on the transmit frequency and the lowest possible insertion loss on the receive frequency or the best possible standing wave ratio. You take a little bit of a compromise of those in order to get the rejection, because the highest priority is the right amount of rejection so that your receiver is not being blasted with transmitter power that's either leaking around your transmitter by way of the power supply wiring or through the jumper cables that don't have double shielding and proper connectors, and through the tuning of the duplexing filter itself. There's 10 ways that a 2-meter or a 450 repeater can be desensitized. there are very few ways of doing it right, if you know what I mean. There's at least 10 ways you can do it wrong, so I have to go a little bit slow.